Hi, this is Tony Bruschi, host of The Grave Talks, the show you're about to listen to. We're very excited about getting this show off the ground, but we can only do it with your support. And that means letting other folks know that this show is out there and exists. And in exchange for doing that, I'm going to give you a special gift. Okay, so what I need you to do is go to the show's podcast page on whatever platform it is you're listening to. So look up The Grave Talks on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, whatever it may be that you download podcasts on, and leave us a positive review, some stars, some nice words. That would be tremendously helpful. And press subscribe. Once you do that, email me, okay, Tony, T-O-N-Y, at thegravetalks.com. When you do that, I will send you an exclusive extra episode of The Grave Talks, one that has not yet been released publicly. You will get it and get to experience it before anybody else. That's in exchange for your support of the show and being one of the first people on board, letting other people know that we exist. Okay? That is in exchange for your 5 minutes of leaving a positive review and subscribing. So do that. Thank you so much. Let's get this thing off to a great start. And I can't wait for what the future holds of The Grave Talks. Thank you for your support. Today on The Grave Talks, the haunted Hinsdale House. The home that's known as the haunted house in Hinsdale, one of the most haunted houses in the area, has all of the elements of a good ghost story. Mysterious history, strange sightings, unexplainable events, even an exorcism. The house, located on McMahon Road, first gained notoriety from the book Echoes of a Haunting. Clara and Phil Dandy lived in the house along with their children in the early 1970s. During their time there, they were visited by many spirits. A priest from the local university was even at the house more than once to perform an exorcism, which worked for a while. But, as with many hauntings, time went on and the spirits returned. The Dandy family lost their battle and ended up leaving the house for good. As the years passed, a few families lived in the home, but many did not stay for long. That brings us up to present day. Daniel Klass purchased the home recently. Daniel has always had a fascination with the paranormal and a connection to it as well. Daniel joins us to talk about his experiences with the home and his experiences with the paranormal throughout his life.
I grew up in a house that had spirits in it. Didn't really recognize that there were spirits until later in life. A lot of weird things would happen when I was young and living in this house, like crayon drawings on the ceiling, and my sister was anal about putting her stuffed animals on her bed. We'd come home and it'd be all splattered throughout the floor. There's times we'd walk in the house and hear singing, and you hear footsteps and creaks and all that kind of good stuff. It was always kind of just sloughed off by my parents. You know, it was a Catholic home, so always was somebody pulling a prank or the house was settling or something like that. But I knew something was there, and I always knew that there was something, you know, out of the corner of your eye you saw something or whatnot. I later in life actually purchased that house. And my kids started experiencing some of the same things that I did when I was younger, to the point where my wife actually saw a female spirit of a little girl. And I'll be going around and around on this because when I turned 18, I went to Lilydale to kind of, you know, I had never believed in psychics or anything like that. My friend was going to this psychic community called Lilydale in New York, and before I even sat down with the psychic, she told me that there were spirits in the house, two kids. And it made sense to me, you know, like all the things that happened were mischievous, but not like bad things, you know. So it's that's kind of like my first experience with it, with dealing with like spirits and stuff like that at my house.
What was the turning point for you where you just had to say to yourself, you know what, everything that's being dismissed here should not be dismissed. There's truly something going on and I know it. I think other people know it, but mom and dad and the dismissal, probably not so accurate.
Well, it was funny because after I went to Lilydale and talked to the psychic, and she kind of gave me this, about the two children spirits in the house, I said, you know what, if I can prove this, if I can prove that there's two kids in the house, then maybe this makes sense to me. You know, like let me make some sense of this. Oh, the one thing the psychic also said is that they were attached to something in the house, which also didn't make sense to me, because I know that there was really nothing in the house that was original to the owners prior to my parents. So I did some research, and then I pulled up the abstract of the house and found the names of the old previous owners, and I started going through microfilm and microfiche, and it was kind of like a, you know, like an episode of Scooby-Doo where you're just trying to cross your T's and dot your I's. And finally, I found a newspaper article about this little boy and a little girl that had died that lived in the house of cystic fibrosis. You know, back then, there was nothing that you could do to, you know, like they have today. I mean, these poor little kids died back then. You know, there's nothing they could do. They had tubes down their throat, and it was kind of a sad story. Mm-hmm. And they were the children of the parents that lived in this house. After I purchased the house, there's an attic. You know, one of those attics that had like little stairs, and didn't have any stairs to it. But I'd never been up there, and I had gotten a ladder out. I just kind of wanted to see what it looked like up there. And I was walking around on the beams up there, and over in the corner I saw these boards, and they were all dusty. And I went over there and I pulled it up, and it was a painting. It was like a painting on wood, and it was a little boy and a little girl playing with a dog. And I kind of just kind of crossed the T and dotted the I for me, as far as like, okay, this is real. These are real things. These are really real spirits. Because when I started acknowledging them, is when things kind of died down. When I knew their names, and when I acknowledged that their existence was there and they were there, I just wanted to die down in the house. And it's always been peaceful, but it was, kind of started my quest of learning of the paranormal.
Did you keep the painting in the house?
Of course. Yeah, I still have it to this day. I mean, it's cool. It's cool to be able to tell the story, you know?
Let's fast forward now to the Hinsdale House, the infamously haunted Hinsdale House. How did you first hear about that?
That was years down the road. I mean, I had joined me and my friend Cameron formed Greater Western Paranormal Society, and we were going to different locations and filming a short video series for Paranormal Reality TV on Roku and stuff like that. But this location in particular, Cameron had booked it and didn't want us to know anything about it. He just kind of told us where it was, said, don't do any research on it. I'll bring you guys all up to date when we get to the location. And that was unlike him, because usually we have like details and, you know, claims and all that stuff in a little binder that we handed out to each team member so we could kind of bring ourselves up to date on the location. So it was an eerie feeling going there. You know, I was driving. This place is in the middle of nowhere, and you just got it going up this mountain, with a dirt road, and turning down this little mud street. And there's this house in the middle of this mountain with nothing around it. It's this little white house, and you pull up, and the seclusion, and that it just gives you that kind of eerie feeling, especially when you're like living in the city. You know, it's just this kind of odd feeling. So we get in there and sit down, and the first thing he has us do is watch the episode of A Dark Forest, of A Haunting, that was based on the Hinsdale House. The original, the Dandy family was in there, and they kind of told the story of what happened to them. And I remember looking at Cameron and I'm saying, are you effing kidding me right now?
I want to hear about that expedition. I want to hear about what happened in that house. When your reaction was, are you effing kidding me right now? But first, I want to go back. I want to understand more about the history of not only the house, but of the property where the house now sits.
All right. This has been a load of research. Up until last June, there's so much folklore and so much story with the land and the property that's been passed along, and there's never been a lot of truth to the folklore part of it, but it adds to the story because many psychics have accounted for the same stories. Just dating it back, I mean, I have the property dated back to 1799 now, where there was an Indian massacre and a witch was burned at a stake. And I mean, just a lot of things happened, you know, that could potentially be reasons for why this place is so haunted. And maybe why the spirits are having a problem crossing over. It's the house was built in 1853. Two brothers, the Everett brothers, owned the house and the property. Now the story that we had from the psychic account was there was two brothers that lived in the house that would kill and murder folks that were coming through on the stagecoach trail, steal their goods and keep their bodies in the house, bury them in the spring thaw in the crawl space or the attic, you know, was what the story was. But we never had any proof of these brothers ever, you know, like, and what happened was the timeline that I had is flawed, you know, and there was a couple of people that both are continuously investigating this place and looking at the history, and basically brought it to my attention that what I had was incorrect. And, you know, I'm about that. You know, I'm not one to admit if I'm right or wrong, but I mean, you screw up, you screw up. It is what it is. But, you know, I think we're all on the same quest to try to find the right answers. So getting the right information opened up a whole new timeline to the house, and just, you know, we've been able to date it back. And then to actually see the 1853, the Everett brothers, two brothers, to correlate with that story was just kind of like a wow to me. Like, okay, wow, this is pretty cool, you know. I'm not saying I know for sure that's the case, but there's these folklore stories from the house, and now there's these two brothers that own the original house and property back in 1853. So it's, you know, pretty, I'm not going to say compelling, but it's just cool to have that story and then have the history and be able to maybe put it together a little bit, you know. There's other stories of the hanging tree. There's a hanging tree. The original property was 100 acres. And there was this big tree that hung over the initial entrance to the McMahon Road that Tom Hinsdale deemed a hanging tree back in the day. That is the truth. It was hit by lightning in 2003 and healed over into the ditch. And there's pieces of it that are still there. You know, we've actually gone down into the ditch and taken pieces of the wood, and some of the wood shoots off EMF. It's kind of odd, kind of an odd thing. But there's a story of a woman, because we always catch this woman in white around the pond where the barn would have been originally, and also an Indian woman. And the story that Alex Tanis had said back in the 70s when he was there with Father Alphonse Trebolt is that there was a woman that was hung wrongly, committing adultery, and that she was pregnant and her husband was off at war, but they couldn't afford wedding rings, and was killed while in the womb. And I mean, how sad of a story is that? But a lot of people associate this woman in white wandering around looking for her husband, you know, as the lady that was hung on the tree. Later stories that the guy came back looking for his wife, and all accounts were kind of just left to the side, and you know, he never found her. And I mean, potentially there could be, I mean, if these stories are correct, there could be hundreds of bodies buried scattered throughout the property, you know. And it's just kind of a spooky thought.
The house that sits there today, is this the original structure from way back when?
It was built in two stages, so the original is there. There were other buildings on the property that are no longer there, like the barn, and there was a way station and the field that is gone. But as far as like looking at my knowledge, the house, the original part of the house is still there on the foundation. And then they added on the second piece to it, which would have been the living room and bedrooms and stuff like that. Because there was originally like a little one or two bedroom with a bathroom outhouse thing.
Obviously, with a history that goes back that far, many people lived in that building. Many people called that structure home.
Yeah, so the house was owned by the McMahon O'Brien family for almost 100 years. And there's not very many accounts, and there's actually letters written kind of trying to debunk the claims that the Dandy family made back in the 70s. But there are some like key things that have happened where I look back and think, you know, the McMahon O'Briens, I don't know what the deal was, you know, but I've met with the grandson, who was there on the property, and he's actually come to the property. He called me and asked if he could come back and see the house, and because he saw it on TV, and his name was Dan O'Brien. And he first thing he said to me when he pulled up in the driveway is, "Where did the rest of the road go?" And I said, "You know, what do you mean?" He goes, "My grandfather used to tell me about how the stagecoach used to come through here, and they would go up to Wagner Hill Road." And I said, "Oh, wow." That was the first time of recollection of having any knowledge of stagecoach coming through, because the way that the house sits, it would be very odd to have a stagecoach trail because of the mountainous terrain and just the way that it's set up. But who's not to say that some came through there, you know? The stagecoach trail itself was more on a flattened part of the land, but it's just for him to say that was like, okay, wow, okay. So the road, I know the road was, I don't know the exact date, but the road was deemed a dead-end road at some point in the late 1800s. And then he walked in, and then after him telling me that, he showed me some really cool old pictures and told me some things that happened to him when he remembers being a kid there. So kind of, I think to myself, back when I was a kid, living in my house and how things were sloughed off, maybe it didn't get violence until the Dandy family moved in, or maybe there, you know, maybe because it's been such a family home, maybe the spirits there were, you know, indicative to that family only. Maybe when the Dandy family started using Ouija boards or doing occult type stuff, maybe that opened up some doors to the negativity. I'm not 100% sure, but that's when all the accounts of the negative things started happening. It was in the 70s when the Dandy family moved in there.
And their experiences in the house, some of the most infamous, if you will. Let's talk about the Dandy family and what occurred while they were calling this house their home.
They started noticing weird things. And a lot of what I'm, you know, my thought process is, say all this stuff happened back in the day, with the bodies being buried and all these treacherous things happened to Indians and whatnot. When the property was purchased by the person that bought her, name was Donna, she took the 100 acres and subpartialed it out into 8 to 10 acre plots, and then was going to put like little cabins on each one and market for hunters, you know. And she had dug ponds on each of the properties. And my whole thought process with that is maybe they unearthed something that they shouldn't have unearthed. Maybe they dug something up or dug up some history that kind of unleashed these spirits out on the Dandy family at that time. Because, you know, Ed and Lorraine Warren came to the house before the Dandy family moved in. And they didn't just come out to any place. You know, I mean, there had to be something going on. So to have them actually come out kind of says, okay, maybe something was happening here that they needed to get checked out. But then this family moved in, and all of a sudden shit hit the floor with them, you know. You know, they were seeing spirits in the woods that they couldn't account for. Knives being thrown into pictures, scrapes on their bodies. I mean, it was kind of a violent type thing. But also it was calming, you know, like even talking to Clara, she said it's the most beautiful, picturesque property. She loved the place. She just didn't like what was happening. And she tried her best to try to fight it off. But it didn't work. You know, I have letters back and forth from her to Father Alphonse Trebolt at St. Bonaventure University. And, you know, and this is actually even before The Exorcist came out. So it's kind of like an unknown kind of weird thing to kind of deal with, and to have this in the papers and stuff, I can't even imagine what they had to deal with the community, you know, as far as dealing with that type of stuff.
Well, there were residents of the home, their phone would ring, and it wasn't necessarily always a friend or a family member or even a telemarketer for that matter. There was other things on the end of that receiver.
They got those type of phone calls, and then they got like these figures coming, like staring at them from the outside. They'd go to the outside, and then they'd be looking at them from the inside. And so many people catch these faces in the windows. It's just really creepy. And I just posted one on my Facebook page today where somebody caught one in the window. And I don't know what they are. I mean, it's weird because they have these big eyes, these big beady eyes. And Jeff, I don't know if you're familiar with Jeff Fent. He is from Columbus, Ohio, but he was there a few months ago. Actually, it was in June. And he was doing some experiments up in the forest with different light spectrums. And when he was using a red light, he caught this creature-looking thing in a tree. And it has these big beady eyes, and you can tell it has tails, but it was like 10 foot up in the tree. It doesn't look like any type of animal I've ever seen before. I have a picture of it.
The family reported seeing things that were almost like a animal-human hybrid. Something that I think a lot of us would look at and go, that was never human. That probably never walked the earth as a living being. So what is it and why is it here?
Yes, she had said that she's seen them. I've never actually seen anything like that, except for now we have this picture. It looks kind of like a human slash cow is the best way that I can explain it. And it has a tail. And it's really odd looking, but it's not huge. It's not like, maybe it's like 4 foot. 4 foot, you know, it would be hard to determine the height because it was up in the tree. And it's the weirdest thing when you go up into the forest, you always feel like something's watching you. You always feel like something else is there. And it's not like a bear or a cat or anything like that. You get the eerie feeling of something's keeping an eye on you and looking over you, or something's kind of watching the property. And for him to catch that picture, it was just amazing to me. Like, okay, we have this picture of this thing now, but we don't know what it is. And perhaps is this what's looking in the windows? Because it's like this one that this girl sent me today from a tour show, that you can see it. It's like a shadow with these big eyes, and it's creepy.
As with many hauntings, things can start out slow, however, very present, very visible, very obvious to those experiencing it. And sometimes it escalates. It escalates to the point of being almost violent in nature. Can you tell me about that when the Dandies lived there?
Well, I mean, as every episode happened, you know, she was communicating with Father Trebolt at St. Bonaventure University, and he was very up to date on like occult things and the exorcisms. And he had offered to actually come out to the house to do a mass. And they thought that, you know, this is a blessing. He's going to come out and do a mass. It's going to help everything. And he did. And it actually did help for a little while. But then it came back full force, you know, with the scratching and the hearing things and the doors being open and seeing these. I mean, she even talked about seeing, like, aliens there, like the alien ships. I've never seen one up close. But when I was there 2 summers ago, and it was after a tour that I did, I was standing in the back, and above me, I looked up in the sky, and it was the most beautiful thing, being in the country and looking up in the sky, and I see these lights come down, and then they stop, and then they, like, zigzagged in the sky with each other, and then they zoomed off, and I was like, what in the heck was that? You know, like, I've never seen anything like it before. I've seen a shooting star. I've you know, this wasn't the case with that. I mean, it was something that had control over what it was doing. And it's like they toyed in the sky and then they both zipped off at the same time and disappeared. It was kind of a weird thing.
Looking back on their experiences and their account of what occurred there, has there been anything you can look at that they did or brought into the home that would have triggered these events to occur or to be more intense than maybe previous residents had experienced?
That I can't. I mean, I can pinpoint the fact that they acknowledged using a Ouija board. I can acknowledge the fact that the earth was undug, that where the barn used to be and a pond was built there, a half-acre pond. You know, I feel like that has something to do with it, you know, because when the McMahon O'Brien family left, all of these ponds were built and unearthed, I think it unearthed something onto them, you know, and that's when, and they were the first family to move there after the pond was built. So, I mean, and they were seeing things before they played with the Ouija board, but could the Ouija board have unleashed more or opened up a portal of some kind if it wasn't closed properly? Perhaps. I have many psychics come in the house and say that this room upstairs is a portal where spirits come and go. And it's funny, I've slept in every room in the house, but that one I have a weird feeling about. Like, you go in there and it's kind of like a static. You feel like static going in there, you know, it's just an uneasy feeling. Now, in this particular room, we named him after the Dandy family, because Mary's room, this room, the Dandy family actually boarded off and didn't want anybody to go into when they were living there. Kids could go, they could open the door, go in there, get something out of there and leave, but she didn't sleep in there. She slept in the master bedroom with the Dandies. So they actually boarded it off and wouldn't let people in there. They thought that was the source of where it was coming from. I mean, if anybody's seen, like, Paranormal Lockdown, the episode of Paranormal Lockdown where Nick and Katrina went there, this is the room where all the flies go. This is the room where all, for some reason, they say, like, insects and bugs are attracted to that. When I first purchased the house, there was a honeybee hive of about 500,000 honeybees that was in the floorboard of the house, of that room. We actually had to cut a four-foot piece out of the floorboard in order to get the bees out, you know, because I wanted to save them, I didn't want to kill them, but that's where everything seems to conjugate in that room as far as, like, bugs go. Even in the middle of the winter, you'll have flies in there or ladybugs. It's just weird, flying around.
Do you suspect the reason for these flies, the reasons for these bugs, the reason for nature to be attracted so fervently to that specific part of the house, do you suspect that that could be tied into the possibility of there being that grave on that very site?
I can tell you that I just had to have a project on there where I had to actually dig up some of the property to put a new septic system in order to keep it usable for teams to come in. We didn't find any bones. We found arrowheads. We found stuff indicative of Indians that may have been on the property. But nothing as far as, like, any human remains or anything like that. I would think, though, that if I were living there, I wouldn't want to bury humans in my backyard. They probably would have put them off to the, you know, past the mountain or something like that. My goal is at some point is to have ground, you know, to come in and check the ground and have a team come in and actually do x-rays of the ground to see what we can find. Without unearthing, without actually digging it all up, just to see if we can find anything. I mean, that's hopefully within the next year we can do that.
From what I've understood about the family that was living there, there would be episodes where the father, the husband in the situation, would go through an experience, acknowledge its happenings, and then almost have amnesia afterwards and not be able to recall certain things occurring. Is that true?
Yeah, and I know that was a stress on their relationship. You know, like, he would say one thing and then not being able to acknowledge it with her after they spoken and clearly, you know, talked about what was happening. And I don't know if that was a tactic on his end to try to schlep off what was going on. But, you know, It's definitely it was a strain on their relationship for sure. Not to mention he was gone a lot too. You know, he didn't spend much time there. Often Clara was left at the home with the family on her own, you know, to deal with the stuff. So, you know, in essence, she was probably feeling like he thinks I'm crazy, you know, or you know, who knows. But it was definitely it definitely happened, and definitely after they left, they ended up getting a divorce. You know, I think that had something to do with it.
Not making for a very happy home. At some point, they decided, enough is enough. What can we do to rid our home of these strange happenings?
So the first thing they did was the mass. You know, they performed a Catholic mass inside of the house. Again, that kind of pushed what was ever in there out for a little while, but then it came back to the point where Father Alphonse Trevolt brought in the psychic with him and actually performed a structural exorcism on the house, kind of like a banishment. He came in and brought a film crew in and filmed what was going on. To this day, we can't find this film. We have no idea where it is, but a lot of stuff is still being protected because the Dandy family is still alive. Like, there's stuff in the archives at St. Bonaventure that we can't get at because, you know, obviously there's still parties involved with those archives that are alive. So we don't have the answers as far as how it went, but we just have, I have a recollection from Clara, an email that she sent to a local historian about what happened when the exorcism happened. And also Paul Kenyon was there when that happened. And he also wrote a book saying, you know, they're still here. And basically what they said is when they started doing the structural exorcism in my house, the building started to shake. The windows were rattling, and it sounded like it was crying. This also pushed when they went and did the structural exorcism, it pushed whatever was in the house out. But then it came back again, and it didn't. And basically, Father Alphonse, his response to the family is just, you know, all we can do is you need to get out of here, you need to leave, you know. And this was something that they spent their whole life working for, to get this property, and now they have to abandon the property, you know, in order to keep their kids safe. And they ended up doing that, and they left it. And then for years, you know, families came in and out of there. I mean, it's hard because the person that bought the house and bought the property subleased the property out, and it's hard because all the people that had it were basically renters. Pay to play type thing. You're buying the house from them directly, and nobody's ever been able to buy the property ever, because nobody stays long enough to hold the contract. You know, it's been sent back to them so many times that, you know, there's not. And at when I was about to buy it, they were gonna burn it down. They were gonna tear it down because they thought that having this house here is not going to make us any money. We'll get more money without the house and just selling the land. And I differ with them because I want to be able to figure this out, you know. It's like a quest of mine.
I would almost go to venture and say that even if the house were to be taken down, that wouldn't necessarily get rid of the spirits. This seems to go even deeper than the house itself.
The fact that they did the exorcisms and they did the mass there and it pushed it away, but then it came back, tells me that a lot of it has to do with the land and the property, not so much the house. I think the house was just built in a spot that is indicative of what's happening to the people there.
Take us now to where you first had an interaction in the house, where you went for your first investigation there with a friend who sat you down in front of a television to show you what you were about to embark upon.
Yeah. So it was, the episode of The Haunting. And I just remember watching it and thinking, what the hell? I'm sitting in a house that there was a failed exorcism performed in. And you didn't think it was good to tell us about this before you invited us all up here. Just, I mean, I would mentally want to prepare myself for that, not just knowing, okay, I'm here. That night, after watching the video, I mean, I didn't feel, I don't know, we were getting some really good EVPs, and it seemed like the spirits that were there knew how to manipulate the equipment that we had as far as when we were asking questions. But then some of the EVPs were dark, you know, some of the EVPs, it sounded like we were getting positive EVPs, like, I'm here, I'm buried, find me, stuff like that, you know, like, you, in the basement, we were getting EVPs saying that. And then we were getting EVPs up in the living room with our equipment going off like crazy. Leave now, you know, this is mine, things like that. And, you know, I remember my co-founder, Cameron, because we were filming, you know, for the show, thought it would be good to have a guest host and brought a comedian up there. And he was sitting in the living room. And when we were getting these EVPs, he flipped out. You know, Mr. Funny Man, like, almost peed his pants and got in his car and drove all the way home, like, an hour into it. Didn't want to be there anymore. Was just freaked out about the whole thing. So just being able to get that positive interaction at the house, like, in such a short amount of time. Like, there's been investigations that I've been on and sat for 8 hours, and we're lucky to get one EVP. But to go into this place and be there for a couple hours and get what we got, I was like, holy cow, this is crazy. And I wanted to go back again to see if it would happen again. And I kept going back, you know, like it was calling to me mentally, like, I need to go back there, I need to go back there. And kept going back because it was just like a hotbed. You know, it's not even a big house. It's only like 1,100 square foot. And you just keep getting, you feel like you're forming a bond with the spirits there.
With that bond that you're making with the spirits that are the inhabitants of that home, do you feel that there's any message that they're trying to get across, that they're trying to use you as a conduit for getting out into the world?
I feel like there's a message, and I feel like we're getting closer to being able to, I keep calling it a puzzle, like you're trying to find pieces of the puzzle. Up until a certain point, all I knew about, you know, was the exorcism and what had happened with the Dandy family, and I met Paul Kenyon, and I had gone up there again, and I said, you know what, there's got to be more to this place. There's got to be more than just this circumstance that happened here with this one family. There's got to be other circumstances happening with other families that have lived here, and I started my quest to try to find other families that may have lived in the house after the Dandy family left. And the first family that I had found were the Misnick family, and ironically enough, a couple days before I was going up to the house, the granddaughter of Joe and Paul Misnick reached out to me and said, hey, my grandparents used to live in this house, and I had found information on them, and she was able to actually give me more information. And I remember going up there to investigate with Cameron, and we have it on video on our YouTube page. But we were all, me and Cameron, in the kitchen with Michelle, my house manager that kind of manages the property for me, and we're talking about the exorcism. Nothing was happening with our equipment. Nothing, you know, we weren't getting any positive responses. And I had a K2 meter in my hand, and just out of the blue, I said, "Flo, are you here?" And I got this static kind of, you know, goosebumps kind of feeling in my arm. And then the K2 meter went all the way to red in my hand. Now, just to kind of go back up a little bit, the house at the time was going through a foreclosure process, had no electricity, had no means or reason for any K2 meter to go off in the house. There was no electric, no power at all. So for me to get that feeling up my arm and feel like I connected with another former member of the house that may have lived in the house at some point was just like, wow. So I continued to ask questions to Flo, and I felt like I connected with her there. And I felt, and I had asked her, Flo, will you hold my hand as I walk up the stairs? Now, you investigate, right? You've been on investigations before. You've used a K2 meter before. I'm sure a lot of people have. It's human gosher. You ask questions, the light goes up, and then it goes down. And when you're asking questions, this K2 meter, when I asked her to hold my hand, stayed lit in my hand all the way up the stairs when I said, can you hold my hand as we go up the stairs? And I was just like, oh my God, this is like crazy. Like, I just felt like a personal connection. And then for the granddaughter to reach out to me a couple days before that, I needed to meet her. And now she's helped with the house. She has a, feels like she has a personal connection with her grandmother there. And I feel like she's there. And I feel like she's kind of, because she loved that house. And she lived in that house for quite a few years in the 1980s. And she dealt with what was ever there, whether it be bad or good. But she said she had an arrangement with the spirits there. They left her alone, or she just didn't acknowledge it. You know, like she lived there until she died. And I feel like she's kind of like a protector of the house. Like she's kind of like one of the angels watching over the house, because there are times when it gets dark and there's times when it's not bad at all. It's just a positive type thing, but you have to be able to deal with what happens on any given day there. And that's what I tell like people that help run the tours there, and they have to protect these people. You know, if something happens, we need to make a decision. So
there obviously sounds like there's a lot of different types of energy in the home, different types of ghosts. Let's touch on the darker side of the haunting and what sort of unexplained entities may be there that never walked this earth.
Now, I've heard it, but I've never been physically, nothing bad has ever physically happened to me in there. There'll be times where I'll be running a ghost box session or getting EVPs or working, you know, trying to communicate. And we're getting positive responses from potential spirits that may have been killed or lived in the house, trying to get names, and then it's just silent, completely silent, and all of a sudden you get this dark, you get this heavy feeling to come over the room, and you start getting these dark responses coming out of the box. I know, like, when Nick Groff was there, he really opened himself up to this. It really affected him to the point where when he left, I was getting responses on my geoport or my ghost box. Where's Nick? Where's Nick? You know, kept asking for him. Like, it wanted him back. It got into his head. And it's happened to a couple other people, you know, that have spent a lot of time there, where you let your guard down because you have to keep your guard up when you're there. You can't just let it in, you know. And there's actually been a second exorcism performed on a human in that house after the fact, which was less than 10 years ago, because whatever this dark spirit was got into their mind and started it. It was partial possession, and he had moved. Now he moved away, and he's in Alabama. It's there, and I don't know how to get rid of it, and I don't know. There's ties to England. There's, you know, looking at paranormal lockdown. There's Pontiff, and there's, you know, it's just a bigger story than what I have, the information I have right now, as far as who it is or what it is or why it's there. And I also feel like, you know, looking at the situation was maybe bringing in a Catholic priest the right thing to do at the time. I mean, obviously back then it's kind of everybody was Christian, you know, but maybe it was something occult. Maybe you need to bring, like, I'm bringing a shaman there. Like, I want to see what he can figure out. Maybe it has something to do with witchcraft. You know, they're saying in the 1700s or 1799 that a witch was burned at the stake. Does it have something to do with something occult like that? But I, you know, I'm going to try everything to try to get answers to see what the deal is, you know?
Do you have any concerns for your own well-being, being so closely connected with these spirits?
I mean, I actually keep my distance. I at the beginning I was going there a lot, and I kind of try to manage it from a distance, and I go around and tell the story and talk about it a lot. But I try to, I've kind of made a team. You know, I have me, I have a groundskeeper, I have a maintenance guy, I have a house, kind of like a lady that keeps charge of the property. And then I have three separate teams of people that'll go in and help do tours and do open for people that are going in, and sign off on waivers and stuff like that. So we rotate the jobs around so we're not all getting overwhelmed with going there so often, you know? Because it was. I mean, it was calling me. And that's one of the things. And even dating back to the 1970s, the house calls you. So many people have a personal connection with the place that have been there. And to the point where they want to keep coming back over and over again. And there was one team that was starting to request to come there every month. And then finally they had to stop doing it, you know, because they were feeling that it was in their head. And I told them, I said, you know, this is, maybe you need to take a little bit of a break. You know, I don't want anything to affect you guys, you know? So, but it definitely has a lure to it.
I have to ask, what was the deciding factor? What made you decide to purchase this very haunted house?
It was the personal experiences that I had there. I, like I said, at the beginning I felt called to it, and I felt like something here needs to have its story told. There's something about this house with all these folklore stories and all the activity that's here. Something more needs to be done. You can't just tear this place down and let it, you know, let it be. I feel like righting the wrongs that maybe have happened to some spirits, or trying to figure out what it is, can set these spirits free. And to this point, it feels like they're locked there, like they can't leave. They don't, you know, it's really sad. Many attempts to exorcise the place or put blessings on them to push them out. Nothing's ever worked. You know, nothing has ever worked. It always comes back full force. So it was kind of just like the personal experiences that I had that I just didn't want to see it go. You know, for the love of the paranormal that I had and what I had been doing up to that point, it was like, I remember my wife, because we had just closed on another house that we had just bought for our family. And I didn't know what was going on with the Hinsdale house. I didn't know if I was going to be able to get it or not, if it was sold at a foreclosure auction or what was going on. And then I finally got the call, and it was two weeks after I closed on my house. And he said, you know, if you come up to this meeting, I know that you truly are interested in buying this place with the house on it. You know, because it was scheduled to be, like I said, it was scheduled to be burned down. And I just remember going up to that meeting with him. He saw the passion that I had for it and allowed me to purchase it. And before I signed the contract, I remember going up to the house. The grass was like 4 feet tall. There was leaks. There was black mold. There was that honey beehive. And I just looked at myself and I said, what the hell am I doing? Why would anybody want to invest their money into this place? And I said, you know what? I need to do this. I need to fix this place up, and I need to make it viable again so we can figure this out. And that's kind of what I did. I went and signed the contract, and I immediately started trying to fix it up to the point where we could stabilize it but not change it.
When you were going through that restoration process, was anything conjured up? Was anything stirred up, good or bad, in that process?
I don't feel like it did. I feel like there was positives when we were restoring it, because I know we were actually fixing it up. You know, we were fixing it up to the point where, okay, we had to knock out a whole kitchen ceiling of black mold. And I think the spirits that are there, that like it there, were happy that we were doing that. But because it's such a busy place and it's very active, I didn't really see too much of a change, because it was always, you could set a K2 meter down, or you could put a recorder down, and you're always going to get an EVP. Or a K2 spike, you know. So it was nothing indifferent. It's just a busy place, and if you're looking for to have a paranormal hotbed, this is it.
Do you have any regrets about buying the property?
No. I feel like it's weird. It's weird because, like, when you make decisions in your life, you know, you sometimes you have to jump out on a whim and take a chance on things. And I feel like I've been able to bring this house out to so many more people, and I've been able to have such great teams from all over the world come in to research it and help with the investigation, to the point where I have enough stuff now where I want to actually put it on display, some of the evidence and some of the history that we found and uncovered, pieces of the barn, the arrowheads, all the letters that I've uncovered. I mean, just all the investigative work that people have done, I want to be able to put out there for everybody. So I'm, you know, going to be putting a museum up there as well.
Is the ultimate goal here to tell the story of the house, or is the ultimate goal here to help the entities that are still at home in the house move on and find some peace?
That's the ultimate goal. That is the ultimate goal, because it's sad. I mean, if they're stuck there, I want to be able to help them, or if somebody else can, that would be my ultimate goal, is to help the spirits move on. I mean, there's no reason they need to still be there. And if something's holding them there, or there's a darker entity that's holding them there, or it has something to do with something that cult that happened, I want to figure it out. I want to help the spirits. It would be selfish for me to say anything else but that. You know, I mean, that's ultimately why I feel like I was put into this place, is to get the house, so I could figure the story out and help these spirits out. Like I said, when you follow your path, when you follow the path that you feel like you're supposed to be on, it feels right, and then this feels right for me.
To find out more about the house, you can visit hauntedhinsdalehouse.com. And to find out more about Daniel's Paranormal Investigation Group, visit paraexpeditions.net. That wraps up today's episode of The Grave Talks. If you like this program, please press subscribe on our main episode page of The Grave Talks on whatever platform it is you download podcasts on. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever it may be. Press subscribe. And if you don't mind, a review would also be extremely helpful. Those reviews help us grow in the rankings and let other folks know that we exist. So please, if you can, spare a moment, give us a review, and press subscribe. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening.